Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, it's a jobs Friday on a Tuesday. We finally get the employment numbers we couldn't get during the shutdown. How much do they matter anyway? Plus, am I only hosting this show because I'm the firstborn child? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Tuesday, the 22nd of October. It's lovely, as always, to have you with us. We are going to start with jobs. We got the September unemployment data today, 2.5 weeks late. Usually, when the government releases its monthly employment numbers, it happens on a Friday. And we economic nerds pore over them to find out who's working and who's not, and what we can learn about the health of the labor market. But, of course, the government shutdown threw a giant wrench in all of this, which brings us to today. We asked Marketplace's David Weinberg to look at these stale jobs numbers and figure out what, if anything, they say.
Normally, when some people think of Friday, they probably start to get excited because that's the day that the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its jobs numbers every first Friday of the month. But thanks to the shutdown, here we are on the fourth Tuesday talking about last month's numbers. So let's start with the basics. 148,000 jobs were added in September.
If we were to put the 148,000 in context, it's slower than the previous 12-month average, which was 185,000 jobs per month.
Elise Gould is with the Economic Policy Institute.
We also see that the unemployment rate was little changed. It went from 7.3% in August to 7.2% in September.
Gould says that overall, this report tells us that we are far from a full recovery. But looking at the jobs numbers from month to month doesn't always give us the most accurate assessment of the economy. It's the yearly data that often paints the clearest picture. Take the unemployment rate.
We've had sustained high unemployment relative to 2007 across all age, education, occupation, gender, and racial and ethnic groups. And that underscores the fact that the jobs crisis stems from a broad-based lack of demand.
Given the delay in these numbers, I asked Gary Bertless at the Brookings Institution if we should be wary of this report, if the data itself was affected by the shutdown.
Not these numbers. Next month's numbers will be affected by the government furlough for two reasons.
One is that the surveying the government does to collect the data will have begun later in the month than normal.
And two, that we should see some sharp employment reductions because people on furlough, I presume, would have said that they are absent from work.
So what will the Federal Reserve do with all this delayed data, especially given the uncertainty that surrounded the shutdown and the debt limit crisis? Bertless expects the Fed will hold off on any big policy decisions.
And so I think they will be cautious about slowing, tapering the monetary stimulus they have been providing.
The Fed will have to wait an extra week for next month's jobs numbers, which were also delayed by the shutdown. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
As you heard, we'll have to wait a bit for the October jobs report. But here's one job we know about already. Yahoo has hired star tech writer David Pogue away from the New York Times. He'll create a new tech-focused, high-profile website there. It's all part of CEO Marissa Meyer's strategy to hire big names and make original content. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Yahoo wants to beef up its original content, and part of that is this new tech site with the celebrated writer it poached from the New York Times. But it has a couple problems. One, the site needs advertising, and consumers are bored with ads.
The prices of banner ads are being pushed down because of a tendency called banner blindness. People just don't look at them anymore.
That's Rebecca Lieb, analyst with Altimeter Group. She says this is Yahoo's latest round of trying to make money from original material.
It is really getting difficult to monetize content, and we did just see Yahoo deliver very flat earnings.
Problem number two, advertisers are getting bored with premium content.
Because remember, on the web, advertisers are increasingly buying audiences.
Brian Weiser is with Pivotal Research. In the past, an advertiser might have bought an ad next to a show that 25-year-olds might watch. Today, they want to reach 25-year-olds who recently thought about buying a snowboard. So if you're going to make a show or website, says Lieb with Altimeter Group, it really needs to stand out.
by having that personality, the celebrity, the influencer.
If Yahoo can establish itself as a go-to place for tech, for example, it can capture eyeballs for all its ads, but it can also experiment with different types of niche advertising. Tim Peterson covers digital media for Ad Age magazine.
Yahoo's ad sales teams could sell sponsorships or sponsor packages tied to this new consumer tech site.
That is, of course, if this new tech site succeeds in standing out. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets shrugged off that jobs data and were green across the board. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It's been 6 months now since the massive garment factory collapse in Bangladesh. The factory was called Rana Plaza, and more than 1,100 people were killed. The disaster prompted lots of calls for companies to change the way they operate in Bangladesh, to know more about the subcontractors they work with, and maybe change their labor practices. We wanted to find out what the situation is like now, so we called up the BBC's Ed Butler. He's in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Welcome to Marketplace.
Good to be on.
So it's been about 6 months since the Rana Plaza collapse. Tell me what has changed since then.
Well, it was at the time the worst, it remains the worst industrial accident ever in this country's history, one of the worst of its kind ever around the world. And it's left huge scars. And there's been a lot of promise that things are going to improve. But so far, there's not been that much sign of substantial change, certainly in terms of building safety, regulation, or indeed in terms of the compensation for those who suffered.
There were 29 companies that were involved there. And my understanding is that only one, Primark, an Irish company, has paid any compensation. When you talk to people there, are they surprised by that at all?
They are surprised, and there is a sense of anger amongst many. I mean, I've spoken to two or three of the survivors this week, and, you know, they say they've got $200. That's the total amount that they've received. So why people haven't been forthcoming with more is an open question. That I think the international brands involved, and there are, of course, a number of American brands included in that list, they say they cannot confirm that they have responsibility for those involved. It's a very confused picture because the factory itself was, it seems, subcontracting work from other factories. So even the brands themselves perhaps weren't aware that their T-shirts, their sweatpants, whatever it was, were being made in that factory.
I know you've talked to a lot of workers in your reporting, and it's not just about safety for them. They also want to be paid more for the work that they're doing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, the minimum wage for Bangladeshi garment workers is something like $1.50 a day. Now, that is just about the lowest in the world. And the rate of pay, the minimum wage, should be going up. I mean, that's the promise that the government is saying. They're in talks this week with factory owners. There is a degree of hope that something will change. But according to the representative of the International Labour Organization, Gilbert Wangbo, there are no guarantees.
When I was here 6 months ago, it was almost a taboo talking about minimum wage. Like, no. Now the debate is when and how.
As you can hear, there is a degree of pessimism amongst some people.
What happens next? The UN has stepped in a bit, but what's the outlook?
Certainly, the international brands have come up with a variety of different initiatives that they say they're going to put in place. There is talk of more money being put on the table and indeed far stricter regulatory conditions. But the bottom line is that the critics are saying it's all too slow and it's all really too uncertain. And this is a country which doesn't have a great record of following through on some of the pledges it makes, particularly when it comes to things like worker safety.
Ed Butler is a BBC correspondent, and he's speaking to me from Dhaka in Bangladesh. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to talk now about one of the most powerful numbers in education. Not graduation rates or SAT scores, but the percentage of kids who qualify for free and reduced price lunch. That's roughly half of public school children today. Their families earn less than $44,000 for a family of four. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott has the first of two stories about the power of a free lunch.
At Rognell Heights Elementary Middle School on the west side of Baltimore, seventh grader Brianna McLean loads up on veggies at the salad bar.
Okay, so what you getting here?
Lettuce, carrots, cucumbers, broccoli. I love the broccoli. And some tomatoes.
This isn't just a salad bar. It's a trophy. Rognell Heights won it from the district because last year every family in the school returned the application form for free and reduced price lunch.
I remember the first time I saw it, I was like so like impressed and I was happy.
The salad bar sweepstakes is part of a big push in Baltimore to get every family who qualifies signed up for free meals. John Walker is interim director of food and nutrition services for Baltimore City Public Schools.
Number one is we want to provide meals to those kids that need them the most within our city. In a lot of cases, a lot of our children, the only healthy meal that they may get during the day would be the ones that they receive in our schools.
But this is about more than lunch. It's about millions and millions of dollars in school funding. That's because Maryland, like many states, gives school districts money for disadvantaged kids based on the number who qualify for free and reduced price lunch.
We get approximately $5,000 per child in state aid for every free and reduced student that we can identify as of October 31st each year.
In other words, what starts with a free turkey sandwich, an apple, and a carton of milk ends up driving more than a quarter of the district's operating budget.
District-wide, what does that amount to?
It's $323 million in total.
Nationally, we're talking billions of dollars pegged to that one number. And it's not just state funding for school districts at stake. Schools also get discounts of up to 90% on their telephone and internet service based on free and reduced price lunch. And many districts use lunch to calculate federal funding for individual schools. At a school like Baltimore's Rognell Heights, that can mean nearly $200,000 in funding. Principal Marie Parfait-Davis says that's money for extra help in the classroom, new technology, or books.
We desperately need all of our parents to fill out those lunch applications because money is tied to those lunch applications. We definitely can't afford to not get any extra funding.
There's nothing wrong with that if there were checks and balances on the system.
Lisa Snell is Director of Education and Child Welfare at the Reason Foundation, a libertarian think tank. She says it's too easy to get the free lunch and all that comes with it. School districts typically have to verify just 3% of approved applications. Snell points to a scandal in New Jersey last summer when more than 100 public employees or their family members were accused of lying about their incomes to get free meals for their kids.
So it would be one thing if it was just a free lunch that these kids were getting. You know, a lot of people say, who cares? We don't want kids to go hungry. But it's actually billions of dollars in state and federal aid that are at stake.
A national study 6 years ago found that one in five families either qualified for benefits and shouldn't have because they earned too much or didn't qualify and should have. Kevin Concannon oversees the program as Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We are repeating that study right now, and I am expecting that we will have seen a considerable reduction on that front.
A reduction because a lot more kids are now enrolled automatically in the lunch program if their families receive food stamps or cash assistance. Those are poverty programs that do require proof of income. Zoe Neuberger researches federal nutrition programs at the nonprofit Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which advocates for low-income families. She says schools shouldn't be in the business of policing what families earn.
Every time USDA has done studies of what happens if you do more checking or ask for more documentation, it becomes very clear that more eligible kids are kept away from getting benefits.
Many high-poverty schools have started feeding everybody for free, so they don't have to count. They rely on other data. But Baltimore's John Walker says the state of Maryland would still make schools collect income data. And without a free lunch attached to it, the city worried not enough parents would hand in that form.
We would take the risk of our percentage going down and us potentially losing millions of dollars in state aid as a result of that.
So every fall, out come the incentives. Last year, it was the salad bars. This year, it might be donated tickets to Baltimore Ravens or Orioles games or school visits from team mascots. But to get there, first you've got to get the applications back. When the financial fate of your school rests in the hands of a lot of little kids, bribes can be in order. At Rognell Heights Elementary Middle School, Secretary Eileen Eldridge cracks open the prize vault.
We have little domino sets, yo-yos, little cars, erasers, pens. We even have erasers that look like cell phones.
And when all else fails?
Kind of gave them a little money incentive so that they can get something down at the cafeteria because sometimes they have snacks. You know, a little dollar, 50 cents. And it really helped us. Last year, by September 30th, we had 100%.
And in 5 years, the district-wide campaign has helped raise the percentage of kids who qualify from about 71% to 84%. That's a lot more kids getting fed and $55 million more dollars in state aid. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Want to follow the food? We've got a graphic that shows how the number of students on school lunch plans trickles down to school buses and the rest of the school economy. Check it out at marketplace.org. How might a firstborn kid be more successful? Let me count the ways.
They go to school longer. They have higher intelligence scores. They're less likely to smoke cigarettes. They're less likely to drop out of school.
And how parents can act like economists to fix that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 75 points, 0.5%, to finish at 15,467. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, 0.25%, to end at 3929. The S&P 500 put on 10 points, 0.5%, to wrap at 1754. Walt Disney swept up 2% and reached an all-time high as analysts expect rising fees for pay TV services. Viacom and CBS also gained about 1% each. Apple lost 0.3%, despite unveiling a new iPad today. Rival Microsoft deleted 1.1%. Procter & Gamble added 1.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to host a meeting with the Prime Minister of Pakistan at the White House. Boeing is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And while we're on the subject of things that fly, the lovable elephant, ridiculed for his big ears, made his debut on October 23, 1941, with Disney's release of Dumbo. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. If you're applying to college, or your kid is, you know what's important. Grades, extracurricular activities, maybe a killer essay. But what if the decision came down to how much money your family makes? This week, George Washington University student newspaper uncovered that the school has put hundreds of undergraduate applicants on the wait list each year because they can't pay GW's tuition. GW previously stated that it was need blind. In other words, they weren't supposed to look at whether you could pay when they looked at your application. Not so much, and they're not the only ones. Sarah McCammon looks at how so-called need blind policies are shifting.
In a perfect world, colleges would accept the best students and then figure out how to pay for their education.
That's the gold standard.
Barmak Nasirian is a policy analyst with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
That's the idealized state of affairs where the admissions office doesn't know whether you're a millionaire or you happen to come from a low-income background.
But with less public funding for higher ed and more students needing financial aid, not all institutions can afford to be so idealistic.
Joyce Smith is CEO of the National Association for College Admission Counseling. She says more universities now have to look at students' ability to pay.
It would be foolhardy not to.
But she says colleges shouldn't encourage a bunch of applications they know they won't accept.
You have to be transparent in your admission approach.
Bar Magnasirian says colleges might also want to tout need-blind policies because they bring in more applicants. And since most of those students will inevitably get rejected, it makes the school appear more selective.
A lot of this stuff is because of the pressure cooker environment that various ranking schemes have created, where institutions are in this perpetual state of competition with each other.
In a statement, George Washington University officials say financial need is taken into account, but only at the very end of the admissions process. But the university is changing how they describe the policy. They're now calling it need-aware instead of need-blind. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
All right, this story about success might get under your skin. Are you the stereotypically overachieving oldest child? Or maybe the dreamy, artistic middle one? Or the baby who broke all the rules and got away with murder? Guess what? An economist says that all that birth order stuff is real. Joseph Hutz is an economics professor at Duke, and he just wrote a paper about this for the National Bureau of Economic Research. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So you co-authored a paper that has the formal name Strategic Parenting, Birth Order, and School Performance, but the upshot here is basically firstborn children are more successful?
It's been well known from a lot of different studies that firstborn children have higher attainments in various dimensions. They go to school longer, they have higher intelligence scores, but it also turns out they have other kinds of so-called successful behavior. They're less likely to do drugs, they're less likely to smoke cigarettes, they're less likely to drop out of school than subsequent siblings in the household. So there's this birth order phenomena, you know, I think pretty well established. Controversial, to be sure, is why. That is, why do you see these patterns?
Well, you're an economist. Why do you see these patterns?
Well, economists tend to be very interested in, people making choices and engaging in behaviors and engaging in sort of providing, incentives for people to do certain things, whether it's through a pricing mechanism or other types of mechanisms. So what we do is apply these same kind of ideas to think about how parents try to influence their children's behavior by using different types of incentives. So starting off with the firstborn child makes some sense to sort of be much more likely to mete out punishments if the child doesn't perform well, or by things like restricting their access to TV, engaging in greater monitoring when of homework and things like that when the child comes home with a bad report card.
So what do you do if you're a second born or a third born and you're listening to this interview and you think, oh my God, my birth order has dealt me this horrible fate?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think that what we're finding, right, I think is sort of indicative of the fact that parents actually have a role here, right? They are influencing what these children do in terms of their types of behavior. Yes, there's these patterns, right? And so in terms of sort of influencing their children, they're trying to do things. And so some of the reasons for the outcomes and some of the reasons for the differences are about what parents do as behavior. We see a pattern here with respect to how they might behave, but that doesn't mean that they can't alter their behavior and sort of deal with children throughout, whether they're the firstborn or the lastborn. I don't think it's such a deterministic it's your fate in life as a secondborn. I'm the third born in my family of five, and so I don't feel like I'm that I'm destined to certain sets of outcomes. I think it's a lot about there's still a big individual component to what people do that's not birth order specific. What this study says is what parents do can have a real influence.
All right, we're talking over microphones. You're not looking at me. You've never met me before, but I want you to take a guess. Where am I in my birth order? Where'd I come from?
That's a good question. I'll say early. You're a firstborn.
Oh, yeah, I am.
Lucky guess.
Joseph Hutz is a professor of economics at Duke University. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
We started the show talking about jobs data, and we're going to end on this final note about economic predictions and the man who won a Nobel Prize for making them, economist Lawrence Klein. He predicted that the U.S. economy would roar back after World War II. He tutored Jimmy Carter during his campaign. His models were used to predict GDP, exports, and all sorts of things that influence the world we live in. In 1976, he told People magazine, "If you are a technician and are asked for help, it is a social obligation of citizenship to give it." Klein died Sunday, and he was 93. Those of us who study all these bits of data owe him a great debt. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 75 points, 0.5%, to finish at 15,467. The NASDAQ gained 9 points, 0.25%, to end at 3,929. The S&P 500 put on 10 points, 0.5%, to wrap at 1,754. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.